Well, we're doing this series during the autumn on Romans, which is a difficult book. And as a result, we're going to be preaching on the theme of Romans during the autumn, but we're also going to make it the theme of our house groups. And Mary Wilson is the leader of the house groups, and she has some packs for the leaders of the individual house groups to take away with them today, with some material on the series. And if you want to look up on YouTube, Mary Beard, who's a Cambridge historian, did a series of four programmes about the Romans, and you can YouTube that and watch it. So Romans is about the capital of a huge empire. I remember London as a child in the 1950s. It was smoky, and I remember it through going in on a train, because we didn't have a car in those days. And of course it was steam trains in those days, and it was a big metropolis. Then later on, when I was an adult, me and my family went to live in Buenos Aires in Argentina, the capital of Argentina. And it's a massive city, and I remember travelling through from the airport through the city to the place where we were going to stay, and it took us forever to do it. 12 million in Buenos Aires in the day when we were there, 1978, and probably bigger now, which is bigger than London. And lots going on there. This is the presidential palace. And then a few years ago, my wife and I went to New York, and I was struck by the buzz of New York. It was like a hive of industry. Everybody seemed to be working away like worker ants. And there's me on the top of the Empire State. So we're thinking about a capital city, Rome, the centre of the world. You could think London in 1900, where Queen Victoria was the emperor, well, empress, of a huge empire coloured pink on the map, including Canada, West Indies, Australia, New Zealand, much of Africa, parts of the Pacific, Egypt, Transjordan, Iraq and Palestine. The British Army and Navy, Victorian Britain with the fruits of the Industrial Revolution, modern technology, system of government and administrative system to rule the empire, particularly in the Indian subcontinent, the jewel in the crown, as Benjamin Disraeli, the Prime Minister, called it. How we conquered and strode across the world, for good and for bad. Raw materials from the empire kept coming in to feed the industry and the people and the trade of Britain. And of course we used slave labour and military conquest to get that empire. It probably reached its peak in about 1921. Britannia not only ruled the waves, but much of the land too. The empire on which the sun never set. And even when there wasn't formal control in a country, British engineers often built, for example in Argentina, the railways, the stock exchange, helped to get the ranching system going, the factories, all that. So going back to AD 57, we're thinking of Paul writing his letter to the Christians who were in Rome. He probably wrote from Corinth in Greece. And Rome, of course, was the centre of the world, of the Western world, in those days. This is the Colosseum. And it's the Forum. It's the place where there are loads and loads of temples, the centre of Roman life, at the heart of the city. And it's still quite an extensive area today. Mary Beard said that in the founding of Rome, Romulus and Remus, these two brothers who were suckled by a she-wolf, according to the myth of the Romans, it ended up with Romulus killing Remus. Fratricide. And in fact, the history of Rome and its rulers was littered with people killing each other, right through until it stopped being the Roman Empire. It supposedly was founded in 753 BC. Mary Beard says that it became an asylum for outcasts and runaways. They needed women, so they took women from the Sabine tribe and raped them What they saw, they wanted, and they took. They were cattle raiders. But they also defeated their enemies and made treaties and alliances with them, calling on them to become soldiers in their armies and to give them goods to keep the place going. 146 BC, Rome sacked, which means they laid waste to Carthage, the capital city in northern Africa, and Corinth, one of the huge Greek cities. But the Romans really liked Greek culture. The statues, the philosophy, the art, the theatre and the literature. So they took on Greek culture as much as they could, especially the story of Aeneas. They controlled the land all around the Mediterranean, the Romans did. They called the Mediterranean Mare Nostrum, our sea. And all roads led to Rome, literally, in them their days. This is the Via Domitia, which goes from Italy to Spain. Don't know if you ever travelled that in a car, but this road went there. 80,000 kilometres of paved roads going pretty straight between centres. Milestones every mile, with information on the milestone about the emperor's name of the time, told you exactly where you were and how far you went to the next place. And Paul, of course, used Roman communications and travelled extensively. But Rome's history can be perhaps looked at as well through its emperors. For about 500 years, they didn't have emperors. They governed themselves with a Senate, which was sort of wealthy landed gentry in a sort of council. And they elected every year two people called consuls to actually do the executive ruling, taking advice from the Senate. You may have heard of him. As far as I'm aware, he was a nasty piece of work. But he was a brilliant army commander, very ambitious, and became so popular with the Roman people that the Senate named him dictator for life in 44 BC. But 1 month later, he was assassinated in the Senate house by the senators stabbing him to death collectively. Then they read Julius Caesar's will, and the surprise was that he made his adopted son, Octavian, his heir. Octavian was just 18 years old. Adoption was pretty common in Rome if you didn't have a son who would be your heir. 2 months after Julius Caesar's murder, Octavian came to Rome to claim his inheritance, Julius Caesar's money, but was ignored by the ruling man in those days, Mark Antony. But Octavian was an army commander, even at the age of 18, and his army was loyal not to the Roman state, but to Octavian. So Mark Antony had to, by the end of that year, because they both had armies, they joined up with another general called Lepidus and made a partnership of the three to rule Rome. They needed money, so they accused about 300 wealthy Romans to be traitors, and they seized their property and killed them. In this purge, the famous lawyer Cicero was assassinated. But the threesome didn't last. Threesomes don't, generally. And Octavian and Antony forced Lepidus to retire. And then Mark Antony and Octavian quarrelled, and Octavian won. Mark Antony committed suicide, and Octavian became the ruler of Rome in 27 BC. When he was made Augustus. And this is him. And he was, in fact, the Caesar ruling at the time when Jesus was born. And he ruled for a long time, for 41 years. And that was the period when Rome expanded into a huge empire, and he became the first proper Roman emperor. He kept loyalty from his soldiers by giving them land when they retired. He built roads and bridges and government buildings and massive public baths and temples and statues. He said, I left Rome a city of marble, though I found it a city of bricks. And he wrote his own obituary on his tomb, which offers a blueprint of what an emperor's like. First of all, you have to be massively generous to the Roman people with bread and circuses. You had to supply them with grain, and you had to supply them with games in the arena, and you needed cash to do that. You had to be a great builder, like one of the former rulers of Rome, Pompey. Augustus was a great builder, and he built temples, theatres, and aqueducts like this one to bring water into the cities and the towns. And of course, you had to be a conqueror, defeating, in Octavian's case, Gaul, France, and Spain. And Rome developed into a huge army with a powerful, a great empire with a huge army. And Augustus Caesar's armies conquered most of Western Europe. And you can see the purple area is the area of their conquest and their empire. Tacitus, one of the historians of the time, said that Rome made a vast desert and called it peace. Pax Romana meant you'd wiped out the opposition. What was the fuel that the empire ran on? Well, it was olive oil, actually. And as a result of that, they forced areas that they'd conquered to cultivate olive trees by the million. So Spain, if you go to southern Spain today, you'll see millions of olive trees. It's very boring in some parts, but that was due to the Romans because they needed olive oil to make the empire run. And of course, with olive oil, to do your lighting, your cooking, and to give you soap and things like that, you needed growers, pickers, pressers, packers, container makers, transporters, warehouses and ports, and armies to protect all that. They've dug down in the Greenland ice, dating the strata of the little column of ice that they dug up, down to, I don't know, about 20 or 30 feet. And they discovered from the time of around about 1 AD that there was a huge spike of methane trapped in the ice, because ice tends to trap the air that is around it at the time. So we look at talking Greenland, and there was this huge spike because the Roman Empire's activity of burning olive oil and other things was huge. And there wouldn't be an equivalent spike for another 1,000 years. So you see what a vibrant empire the Roman Empire was. They're famous for building towns, aqueducts, baths. They loved their baths. Buildings, amphitheatres, they loved them, amphitheatres, temples, houses and roads. And they often built these in the conquered lands as statements of power. We are now your rulers, you're part of us. Another interesting thing that the Romans were very good at was building sewers. The Cloaca Maxima, the big sewer in Rome, was probably the biggest in the world at the time. And whenever they conquered an area, they modelled the area, the towns, on Rome itself with its governing system, the amphitheatres and everything like that. Another thing that happened in Spain to keep the empire running was silver. There were 40,000 people working in the silver mines, mostly slaves, smelting the silver with high chimneys to take away the fumes. And they sold the right, the Romans, to run these mines to publicani, publicans, which you hear about in the New Testament, public servants who were running it on behalf of the Roman state. Children were used in the mines, and the silver went into coins. And here's a denarius, a silver denarius of the Emperor Hadrian, a little bit further on from the Book of Romans time, which was found in Bletchley, England, and in southern India, with this same emperor's coin being discovered there. So you see how widely the Roman Empire reached from England to India. A single empire currency, not a European currency, an empire currency. Wealth, power, taxes, wages. But as they went on, the Romans realized that when they conquered a place, they couldn't make it like Rome. So they didn't impose Latin, the language. They didn't say to people, you must worship Roman gods or use the Roman calendar. But they used this power, a soft power, to say to the elite in a country, if you want to be part of us, you can become a Roman citizen as a gift. No citizen test or fee. You didn't have to salute the flag. Roman citizenship was valuable because it gave you legal rights. You could have a marriage contract, which is probably quite nice if you're insecure in that area. And you couldn't be crucified, which is a definite plus. It gave you a stake in Rome, rather like the American dream. The Roman emperor worked by bringing people in rather than keeping them down, although they had to do a lot of that. And you remember St. Paul was a Roman citizen, and this gave him special access to the Roman world. Who was the emperor at the time when Paul wrote to the Romans in 57 AD? It was Nero. Nero was about 20 at this stage. He'd been emperor for about 2 or 3 years. And he was an interesting person. He started off okay. He would have worn a toga, because every time a Roman citizen person became a Roman citizen, they were entitled to wear the robes, the toga, as a sign of citizenship. Here's Nero being crowned by his mother. But Nero was an interesting person, as I've said, and in 58 AD, which is the year after Paul wrote Romans, he had his mother killed. In his early years, when Paul wrote the letter to the Romans, Nero had a tutor called Seneca, who was the Stoic philosopher. And things were relatively stable during those early years of his reign. But as time went on, it seems that Nero got a bit more unhinged and did away with Seneca and his advisors and just let rip with his weird ways, which was very costly to people. Lots of Christians died because Nero blamed them for a great fire in Rome. And later on, both Peter and Paul met their deaths in Rome in AD 64, during Nero's time. What about religion then? Well, the Romans worshipped many gods. They were polytheists. And each god had its own temple. So the temple of Jupiter in Rome, is that's all it is today, but it would probably have looked more like this, which is a temple today in Baalbek in Syria. Quite an elaborate temple. Temples were closed most of the time. They didn't use them for baptisms, for weddings, or for worship. They had the statue of the god inside, but they were generally unused. Typically, a general would invoke the help of a god. O Jupiter, help me to win this battle against the French, the Gauls. And if he was successful, he built a temple to house the statue of that god. They had mostly adopted Greek gods. Neptune, the god of the sea. Minerva, the goddess of sailors. Hercules, god of protection for humans. Mercury, the god who helped you to get places and communicate, helped you to make a profit. But they also took on the worship of other gods from the lands that they conquered, like Isis from Egypt, or the mystery cults from the Iranian area called Mithras, as long as the Roman gods were sacrificed to as well, because they believed that if you kept the gods on side by sacrifices, they would keep the Roman state going. They didn't believe in their gods in the same way that we might as Christians. They didn't have faith in them. They just thought, well, if we keep them sweet, they'll keep us going. So they made offerings of drink offerings, bulls, pigs, sheep. So religion and politics were very much bound up together. They didn't have a creed of their belief or a code of ethics. You could behave as you liked as long as you sacrificed to the god and keep the god on side. And so if you did the right rituals and offered the right sacrifices, you kept okay. Just before the time in the New Testament, in 27 BC, a temple called the Pantheon, which means every god, was commissioned and started to be built. There is a present building that is a massive dome in Rome today, but that was completed after this time by the Emperor Hadrian, who built Hadrian's Wall, obviously. And this was a temple dedicated to all the gods. So they had statues of all the gods that they kept wanting to keep on side with. When monotheism arrived in the form of Judaism and later Christianity, it jarred with what the Romans thought religion was about. Because the Jews didn't have a statue of their god in their temple. And so the Jews were known as atheists, which is logical, because there was no god in their temple. And I wonder how our faith today clashes with the assumptions of the culture that we live in. Well, as we've said, the empire extended to a huge area of the Mediterranean and beyond. And people came from all over that empire to live in Rome. So they might come as tradespeople, citizens, soldiers, or slaves. And some of them, of course, were in Jerusalem for the time of Pentecost in 33 AD or thereabouts, 24 years before Paul wrote the letter. And it was mentioned in Acts chapter 2. And some of them might have gone to Rome to escape the persecution that happened after Stephen was martyred in 35 AD. And in 52 AD, this is 5 years before Paul wrote the letter to the Romans, in Acts 18, there's a record of Paul meeting two Roman Christians who were Jews, expelled from Italy. That's because an emperor, Claudius, of the time, had expelled all the Jews from Rome in 49 AD because they were constantly rioting at the instigation of Crestus, probably a misunderstanding of Christus. It may have been because Jews and Christians were having skirmishes between themselves at that time. And then when Claudius the emperor died in 54 AD, just a few years before Paul wrote, Jews were allowed back into Rome. Now the tricky thing is that when you have a group of the church that's expelled from the country, an ethnic group, the Jews, those who are left take over the leadership and guidance of the Christian churches in Rome. So Gentile Christians probably took the lead in Rome when the Jewish Christians were expelled. And then when they were allowed back in 54 AD, there were probably tensions there. And that may have been one of the reasons why Paul wrote to the Romans as a reconciler to try and help the tensions between Jews and Gentiles who were both Christians. But the Jews coming back into Rome, discovering that all the leadership's gone to the Gentiles. And you'll see in the letter to the Romans later on that Paul deals with some of these issues about what the place of Jews in the Christian faith. Anyway, by the time 57 came and Paul's letter arrived with Phoebe, there was a network of house churches. And some of them would have been Christians and some of them would have been Jews. The Roman population of the city at that stage was 1 million. The Christians would have been, a few thousand perhaps at most. So why did Paul write his letter to the Romans? Well, he wanted to heal any pastoral tensions that were there as a result of the displacement, perhaps. And when Paul had been converted, when Jesus called to him on the road to Damascus, He said, be a messenger of mine to the Gentiles. And as capital of the Gentile world, it was logical that Paul should go to Rome. And he wanted to do that on another missionary journey, which he wanted to do to Spain. So, even though Paul didn't know it at the time, the letter to the Romans arrived in 57 AD, which is a few years before Paul arrived himself under house arrest. So it's very important that his letter paved the way for the imprisonment that he didn't know he was going to have there. So what do we know about Paul? He was an intellectual. He was a Pharisee, a very strict Jew. He was a keen persecutor of Christians and then an apostle. He was very influential when he spoke to people. All sorts of people became Christians through him. He was able to debate with rabbis in Jerusalem, scholars in Athens, washerwomen on a riverbank, jailers in prison, governors and kings. And of course, he was a very courageous Christian because he endured all sorts of suffering and ultimately beheading. Because you couldn't be crucified as a Roman citizen, so you were beheaded instead. And Paul calls himself a slave. And I think the last thing I want to say about the Roman Empire that we haven't looked at before is slavery. Rather like the British Empire at one stage, where slavery was a major factor, the Roman Empire was built on slavery. Because you had citizens, and then he had the people who served them. Slaves, as you probably know, were considered property under Roman law and had no legal personhood. They were unpersons. Unlike Roman citizens, they could be subjected to corporal punishment, sexual exploitation, prostitutes were often slaves, torture, and summary execution. You could kill them without getting any penalty about it. And the testimony of a slave was not accepted in a court of law unless it was extracted under torture. Romans went shopping for slaves. So if they wanted a gardener, a tutor, a lady's maid, a miner, a farm worker, a doctor, a musician, a cook, you went to the slave market and got one. Slaves made up around one-fifth of the empire. But in Italy, it was 40%, two-fifths of the empire. So it's a daunting prospect. Paul calls himself a slave to be part of a minority faith in a successful majority culture. And here's another little bit of where the slaves went. This is a Roman soldier leading two slaves who are chained by the neck. Often they're prisoners of war. This is a little model of the Circus Maximus, which is like a big sort of chariot racing area. But they also had all sorts of games and everything that they had going on there. Apparently about 300,000 slaves were used to build it. And it seated 150,000 spectators, so it's much bigger than Wembley. And of course, many Christians met their deaths later on in that very place. This is what it looks like today. And the wealthy Romans built their houses off to the left there on the Palatine Hill. And they had an armchair seat for the games, as it were, that went on. And it made me think, we are probably rather like the Christians of those days. A minority group, a minority faith group, within a majority culture that is far too preoccupied with all sorts of other things other than God. And rather like the slaves or the Christians of those days, we're on exhibition in the arena to some degree. When I was a teenager, there was a song called They Are Watching You, They Are Watching You, All You Do, Hearing Every Word That You Say. And judging you on what a Christian is by your own life. And that's always been something that's made me think about my own life as a Christian and as a person. The forum was the place where all the business went on. Slaves were only there to accompany their masters. But Rome generally was the arena, if you like, for the Christians who were there at the time when Paul wrote. And here's a model from a little bit later on. So the challenge for you and me is, if we are, do consider ourselves to be followers of Jesus, is that we are a minority within a large and relatively successful culture. But I think that the people around us, when we go to work, when we're at the school gate, when we're doing whatever we do, are looking at us to think, well, who are these Christians? We know that the church is a thoroughly discredited organization, full of corruption and hypocrisy and sexual exploitation. So what do we make of these people who say that they're Christians? And that's, I think, for us, for me, I feel that's the challenge today. Because I feel people within the majority culture have taken the moral high ground and say that Christians are definitely discredited. So we've got a battle on. Almost we've got to outlive, outlove the people in the majority culture so that people may see something of who God is, something of who Jesus is, and something of the way that the Holy Spirit can change lives, like we've had the demonstration of today.